Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. I pray all is well with you. Welcome to the Orisha Lifestyle Academy. This is our leadership conversation on personal management for spiritual progress. This is our third conversation. Today is the 20th, I believe, of, yep, today's April 20th, 2022. And we're going to have a good chat, I believe, today on coming to grips with what we need to get things done, what we need to be excellent, you know, not just complete tasks, but to be excellent and not just excellent in the sense that we get the gold star or we finish first, or we get the highest number, but excellent also in the sense that we're fulfilled by what we do. We're gratified by what we do. We're authentic in what we do. One of my recurring sayings, if we say a mantra, so to speak, is that, you know, I can never attain true excellence by pretending. You know, I can't be pretending to be something that I'm not and call that excellence, because on the inside, I know I don't feel I'm not authentic. So we're broadening our understanding of what excellence is to include this sense of authenticity. And that's going to be an important part of our conversation today. but as is always proper, because we are operating within the paradigm of spiritual progress as defined by Orisha Lifestyle, we know that what we're doing is at the behest of the divinities and with the support of the ancestors. And so it's only proper that we invoke those forces that make it possible for us to have the conversation first. So we give thanks to Olodumare, the great king who spreads his mat infinitely in all directions, Ashe. We give thanks for Olodumare's attentiveness to our concerns as people. We praise you, Olodumare, the ever weeping king. We praise you, the one who is always fretting over your creation. We praise you, Olodumare, as the ultimate sanctuary of all existence. You are who is the owner of today, the owner of tomorrow, the owner of every day that has ever existed and ever will exist. We pay homage to you and we praise you, Olodumare. We pay homage to our mother, the earth, Ile Ogerea Fukuyeri, she who adorns her hair with a hoe, the supporter, the nurturer, the sustainer of all human activities, the witness of all of our wisdom as well as our folly, the gracious one who patiently accepts both our wisdom and our folly and does not hold it against us and does not deny her love as a result of our shortcomings. We give thanks that the earth is so generous and so patient that she continues to generate sweet peas and potatoes and fresh air and clean water, chickens and roosters and goats and all of the little elements of life that we don't even understand. Even though we spend so much time, we're trying to exterminate the bounty of the earth because it makes us uncomfortable. She continues to balance things out and allow us to live long enough to figure out that there are no mistakes. All of these things that are on the earth are here because they have a purpose and a reason for being. So we give thanks to you, Ile. We pray that our wisdom will increase, that it will intensify, and that we will learn to be much less foolish in our endeavors. Hashem. We pay homage to the rising sun, the beginning of a new day, the commencement of a new cycle, a new opportunity to reinvent ourselves and re-envision our lives and see what is truly possible for us based on our prenatal choice. We pay homage to the setting sun, the completion of a cycle, the opportunity to evaluate our lives, evaluate our activities, evaluate our performance, and pat ourselves on the back and celebrate our successes where it is appropriate, and then also to adjust and correct ourselves, hold ourselves accountable in those areas where we fall short, where we miss the mark, where we don't quite measure up to the standard of greatness that has been set forth by our ancestors. We don't quite measure up to the standard of greatness that we chose in the prenatal state. We pay homage and we give thanks for the setting sun and the end of a day that gives us the opportunity to recalibrate ourselves. Ashe. We pay homage to all of the divinities, those whose names we do know. We pay homage to you, Orumila Eleripi. We pay homage to you, Eshu Odada. We pay homage to you, Odeye Yeoshun. We pay homage to you, Opatala Obatarisa. We pay homage to you, Okunlakayo Sinimole. We pay homage to you, Shango Lukoso Kabiesia Hayana. We pay homage to you, Oya Oridi Afefeina. We pay homage to you, Olokun Seniade. We pay homage to you, Osain Olubiki. We pay homage to you, Egbe Akika, as well as to you, Ibeji Elemere. We pay homage to all of the deities whose names we know and those whose names we do not know. We celebrate your excellence and the principles of life that you uphold and demonstrate for us. We pay homage to you and we give thanks for the ways in which you support us as Enya and guide us and help us to be good benefactors and good recipients as well of all the bounty of Olodumare, all the bounty of the earth. We give thanks to you, our Irumale, who show us the way to optimize Olodumare's blessings. I say, we pay homage to the spirits of our ancestors, those great men and women who came before us, who sacrificed immensely so that we might have this opportunity to call ourselves by our true names and to walk our true path. We pay homage to you, all those great men and women who had to bear crosses, even though they knew that they did not believe in crosses, so that we could hold Ikin, so that we could hold Opele, so that we could hold Erindilogo, so that we could throw Obi, so we could call ourselves Obafemi, or Jegbe, or Bemisola, or Oshundoin, so we could call ourselves by our correct and true names. And we pay homage to you. It was you, our ancestors, who suffered and sacrificed. Showed us the way of dignity and integrity. For if it had not been the example that you gave us, how to walk with integrity, how to walk with pride, how to walk with confidence, we wouldn't even imagine being able to restore our ancestral memory. You showed us the ancestral memory in everything that you do, everything that you did. And we pay homage to you, we celebrate you, we acknowledge you, we praise you, we elevate you, we put you on the highest level. Ashe. We pay homage to the spirit of our mothers and the spirits of our fathers, as well as our own internal spirits and the spirit of our Ifa, that thing that each and every one of us must walk and live and experience in order to be transformed and made whole. We pay homage to the most senior member of our kingdom. We pay homage to the youngest member of our kingdom. And we promise that everything that we do, everything that we accomplish, everything that we become, will be dedicated to making sure that the future generations will be able to walk with even greater pride and greater providence than we have in this time. Ashe. Modupo. Welcome, 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 good people. This is our third conversation on personal management for spiritual progress. This is a conversation that's intended to prepare you for the success that Ifa brings. This is a class that is here to give you some inkling as to what happens as a result of being a devotee. What happens as a result of living the lifestyle? Things get better. You improve, you elevate, and your responsibilities increase. If your responsibilities aren't increasing, if your load isn't getting heavier, if your influence isn't broadening, then chances are you're working backwards, right? This is a life in general is intended to be, you know, a progressive movement where your awareness and your understanding broadens, but also your capacity broadens. And this is why we cherish elders so much. You see, being an elder is synonymous with being a leader. The elders aren't the elders just because they have been around longer. The elders are elders because in being around longer, they've cultivated wisdom. They've accumulated resources. An elder accumulates all kinds of resources, financial resources, emotional resources, spiritual resources, social resources. That's why they say an elder can see sitting down that which a child cannot see standing up. The youth might know how to travel the path, but the elder, the youth may know the path, but the elders know how to travel it. The youth know how to cut the tree, but the elders know where it will fall. The youth know the song, but the elders know the story. We cherish the elders because they are the repositories of greatness, right? So in our tradition, the best thing you can do is be old. That's the very best thing that you can do. The older you get, the better it is in our tradition. But that requires greater responsibility. People lean on you further. People depend upon you more. And you want to be prepared to take that on with grace. You don't want to be angry and brittle and trying to get out of it. And why do people keep asking me for help? And no, it's a sense of great pride that the youth, can, they come to you with questions. They come to you needing guidance and needing resources. So when I talk about, you know, this particular class as a leadership development mechanism, it's synonymous with eldership. This is tapping into our appreciation of and dependence upon eldership. We desperately need elders. When I was 20, maybe 22, I could sense that I had a different idea of life. It was abundantly clear to me that my perspective was different. But I knew I wasn't finding my perspective anywhere. I had been through university, I had traveled abroad, I had worked jobs, but I wasn't seeing myself reflected in the world. I wasn't able to look ahead of myself and see, oh, that's where I'm going. That's the guy right there. That's my guy. I want to be like him, right? This person is doing what I want to do. It didn't exist. I didn't see it anywhere. And so I started looking, searching. And the search took me out to, by this time I was living in Southern California. I ended up at Leimert Park in Los Angeles, like in the Crenshaw District. It's like a kind of a historic Black cultural hub. So I ended up, me and my best friend, we ended up out there searching for what we didn't know. We just knew that was the closest vibe. We had an affinity for that vibe. And it was then that I met my first teacher, right? Not literally out there, but in that era, in that time frame. And meeting him was everything. I mean, everything. Because finally I was able to recognize someone who could recognize me. I could see that he recognized me. Things that I would say to other people and it would just go just right by him. They had no response. They didn't know what I was talking about. He knew exactly what it was and could, you know what I mean, and contextualize it and give me deeper insight into what I was envisioning. And that, of course, is Babalade Olamina. I'm always talking about Babalade because he was my first teacher. And if it had it not been for him, I don't know what would have happened. But he demonstrated for me what it means to be an elder. And he continues to demonstrate, you know, those qualities and traits up to this very day. And so a lot of also what we're talking about is the understanding that without people like Babalade, so many of our younger practitioners and members of our community, they just don't have guidance. It's impossible for them to find the way. Some of them will get lucky, but the overwhelming majority will just flounder, you know, longer than they need to. So this is essential for us to progress collectively. We need people to own this position of eldership and leadership. It's crucial. Okay, so that's part of what's driving me through this particular conversation. We need more people who are looking forward to being real elders, right? Real elders. And I address this in my book, The Fundamentals. A lot of the ideas in this chapter or in this whole conversation are in the chapter of The Fundamentals that's called Owo. Owo being your craft. So we go in the third section of the book is spiritual energy, where we look at Egbe. We looked at your the marketplace. We look at your natural gifts and talents, and we look at Owo, your mentorship, and we look at the mentorship apprenticeship model in Yoruba tradition. And so if you want to kind of get some more context, go and get the fundamentals of Orisha lifestyle. Check out the third segment of the book, which starts spiritual energy. And particularly, there's a sub-segment in that chapter on Owo, your craft, and Oja, the marketplace. Okay, so that's kind of like the philosophical seed of this particular conversation. I started to go back to my work and draw from it, you know, and try to make use of it. So leadership and eldership are built into the system, and we need to actively condition ourselves to occupy the position of eldership and leadership. So to that effect, last time we talked about forming an ideal apprenticeship, right? Our previous conversation was all about forming an ideal apprenticeship. And we talked about the idea of following your bliss. Excuse me. We talked about, following your bliss. We talked about, of course, optimizing your natural gifts and talents. We talked about finding, you know, once you know your natural gifts and talents, find a noble master and give your talent to that person. I can't emphasize that enough. It's super, like, that will bypass all the rigmarole, because it keeps you in the driver's seat of your own life. The second you come out into the internet world talking about, I want to be a priestess of Yemoja, you're about to become a sucker. How do I become a Babalawo? You know what you're going to become? You're not going to become no Babalawo. You're going to become somebody's paycheck. So don't even, just forget about it. I'm a priest of this, I'm a priestess of that. Forget it. Just wipe that from your mind. Stop thinking on those terms. Think in terms of what you do. I'm a painter, I'm a dancer, I'm a singer, whatever it is that you do naturally, that's where you focus. And then you find someone who you want to give that to. Say, oh, this person over here, I like the way she gets down. This guy, this dude has the formula. I'm going to give what I do to this person. Now you may not be able to do it 40 hours a week. I can give you 10 hours a week. I can give you an hour a week. I'll come and I'll paint, or I'll sweep, or I'll sing, or I'll sew. Whatever it is that you do, give it. And just give it. That's your service. That's your offering. But it also allows you to observe. It allows you to get close. It allows you to see how things play out. And it does not oblige you to be on the hook for whatever, upsell that this person has, right? You don't have to be buying stuff. You don't have to be, you know what I mean? You just don't have to. I'm just here to do your carpets. I'm the city's best carpet cleaner. I got the best carpet cleaning company in the city. And I'm going to make sure your carpets are clean in this temple or in your house. I'll be here every week without fail, and do it. It sounds crazy, but trust and believe. This is the Karate Kid technique. It works. It works. You're going to learn more and you're going to do more from that angle than you ever would from just trying to run down somebody and get a pot. That just one time out of 1,000, you're going to hit the jackpot with that. But most of the time, it's going to be a dud and you're not going to be happy. So we talked about that in any way. And that comes down to, you know, making a contribution. The other reason why that's so important, and this is kind of segueing into our conversation today, the power that we seek through the deities is not only vested in the deities. The power that we seek through the deities is not only vested in the deities. You have that power. That's the power to make a difference. That's the power to add value. That's the power to influence. And the influence doesn't only come from saying incantations and making sacrifices. The power comes from you showing up and applying yourself. And then you'll get you get the chance to see. And once you start to see that when you apply your natural gifts and talents to the place that you want to apply them, and you see the impact that you have on people's lives, that will transform your consciousness and give you all the inspiration that you need to go further and further and further with your discipline, which is reinforcing what you chose in the prenatal state in the first place. It's an inside out approach that I'm advocating for. Totally inside out, not outside in. Okay. So know who you serve, and serve valiantly, serve religiously, serve relentlessly. Service is like forgiveness. People are reluctant to forgive because we want to punish each other. You hurt my feelings, so I feel like I should punish you. So by not forgiving you, I feel like that's a punishment. That's going to harm you. You're going to see my screw face every time we meet. I'm going to say hostile things to you. I'm going to, you know what I mean? And I feel like punishing you, but really I'm punishing myself. I'm not punishing you. I'm punishing myself. I got to carry that nasty feeling, those gutter emotions. I got to carry those around me all the time. Always have them at the ready. Anytime I see you, anytime somebody mentions your name, I got to just be spitting bile. That ain't harming you. That's harming me. So forgiving you is in my best interest. That's how I purge myself. Let you off the hook. Let that all go. Drain all that nonsense. That's forgiveness. Service is in the opposite direction. We're reluctant to serve because we feel like if I give it away, then you're going to take what I have. If I serve you, then somehow you're going to be greater than I am. If I serve you, you're going to be able to run off with whatever it is I'm telling you. So, no, I'll never do that. I'll never do that. But it's the same thing. Now you're stagnating yourself. You're stagnating yourself. What you got is not going to come to fruition by you keeping it in your pocket. It's not going to grow by you just hoarding it and holding on to it, knowing secretly that it's really good. It's not really good until it actually does really good, and it can only do really good in relationship to other people. So you got to serve. In order for you to really know what it is, you've got to give it away. You've got to give it away. And people, if you think I'm lying, go look on my YouTube channel. Go read my blog. Go read my Facebook. Go thousands and thousands and thousands. I got more free content. You could spend the next 15 years of your life studying my free content. That's not an exaggeration. The stuff that I give away. Why? Because that's my service. I love it. I could not live without it. And the more I serve, the freer I become. When we went to Orlando this past weekend, and one of the surprising, experiences was having people recognize me and come to me and say, I watch all your videos. I've been watching your videos for years. One gentleman who was actually an elder, like my father's age, close to it. Oh, you saved my life through those videos. You don't know how many people's lives you saved through these videos. And I said, wow. I'm humbled. And I'm very, very thankful that you said so. I really appreciate you saying so. Because it lets me know that the thing that I love is being received by the people who I really intend to serve with it. And it has the desired effect. But it's free. They don't have to tell me. And they don't. Mostly they don't tell me. If they don't see me, they don't tell me. I don't know. I don't know who I'm talking to. I don't know. So I just say that to emphasize the fact that I know this from experience. Give it away. Now you give it away on your own terms. Right? You give it away on terms that will not destroy you. Right. So I recorded my videos and wrote whatever I wrote in a capacity that was okay with me. I already had work, right? Maybe in some of those times I had a corporate job. Some of those times I was in between doing things. I had a, you know what I mean? I got 4 hours in my schedule that are open. And so I do this, right? But that's a way I can show up and it doesn't deplete me. It feeds me, it enriches me. And so that was our conversation last week. And that's crucial because it sets the stage for what, you know, we're going to talk about this week and kind of what's happening behind the scenes when you show up in this way, when you are a service-minded person, because a leader is a servant. Leaders serve. That's what you have to do as a leader. You serve. Okay. Just like a priest is a devotee. If you can't be a devotee, you can't be a priest. You can't pray for people. It's a service, right? You can't see a person fall down and you can't stop and pray for that person. You can't be a priest. You can't. Priesthood is devotion. That's all we're doing. It's just a different kind of devotion. We are worshiping. That's all we do all day, every day. Worship, worship, devotion, devotion, all day long. Worship and devotion. The key is to craft your life in such a way that everything that you do becomes acts of devotion. And that's another conversation. We're going to get into that. So what's the nuts and bolts of what I really want to share today? Service and adding value are integral to leadership because they support meaningful action. Okay, meaningful action. One of the things that destroys the quality of our lives here is this sense of isolation, this sense of aloneness, this sense that I can't relate to anyone and I'm not attached to anything significant. Think of the times where, you know, you have to go to work or you have to go to school or you have to, maybe you get punished for something, you know, and you're toiling with the grind of doing this activity. And the bad part about it is that it just doesn't make sense. It just seems so empty. Who was I talking to? You ever go to like, or if you've ever seen killer whales in captivity, and you know how the killer whale has that big dorsal fin? I mean, that fin is probably like 4 feet tall, right? But when they're in captivity, the fin is droops over. Have you all seen that? You ever seen that? The fin on the killer whale is in captivity. That's their broken spirit. That's their broken spirit. They're depressed. And they're depressed because they live in a tank. This is a thing that's used to swimming hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles. And they're kept in a tank, swimming in a circle, day after day after day. Never seeing any of the other animals, never experiencing the natural events that you will find under the ocean, the different plant life, the different fish, never having to run down and capture their own fish, right? They're in a state of deep depression. That's why the fin is broken. Like, that's us. That's us. Our skin don't shine like it ought to. Our eyes not bright like they ought to be. Our voice don't ring like it's supposed to ring. Because we're cooped up in these little boxes and we're just doing what we did yesterday and the day before so that we can, you know, keep lights and room and et cetera. It's what has to be done to an extent, but at the same time, it breaks our spirit. It breaks our spirit. Why? Because the activity is meaningless. It's meaningless. When I used to work, I was an implementation engineer for WorldCom for a few years. And I wasn't a tech guy. So in the beginning, it was exciting because it challenged my mind, like to learn all these different programs and stuff. But then once the adrenaline kind of rush went down from learning new things, the more I learned that job, the more I hated it. The more I worked with my clients and I understood what they needed, the more I resented them because it was totally meaningless. I was talking to people who I didn't know about things that I didn't care about and trying to resolve problems that honestly didn't matter to me one way or the other. The entire act was futile for me. It had no significance. Right. So I know that bent dorsal fin of the killer whale, that was me. That was me. I was a mess. Did not want to be doing it at all. It never added anything to me. Right? And so in the process, those are the years where I call my golden handcuffs. All my tech years were golden handcuffs years. I made good money, but I hated my job. I hated my existence. And I'll never forget once, kind of close to the end, we had a team meeting. And our department head, his name was Sylvia something. and she said, well, you know, what would you be doing if you weren't doing this? And I listened to my colleagues, you know, and they were talking about other kinds of corporate endeavors that they would pursue. And in my mind, I was listening. I was like, oh, that's very interesting. Y'all would sign up for another tour of this? Not me. So finally, when my turn came, I said, what would you do? I said, you know what? I will go straight back to the woods. I go straight back to the woods and I will be with them children. And I'd be singing and dancing and walking and hiking and all that. And I would not look back. And I admit it. It was the honest to God truth. I really, really, really wanted to get out of that place. And the time came and I did. Maybe a year or so later, the company got acquired by another company. They gave us some nice severance packages and I was out. I went and took my little money and I went straight back to the woods and I never looked back, you know, because working with the children in the woods was meaningful. I could tell, you know, for me, seeing this child show up on day one and be terrified of the dirt, for example, or this one don't, you know, we walking on a path. The path is like 5 feet wide, but it's a cliff. There is a cliff on the side now. It is. Man, you see the child who walks they lean against the mountain and slide against the mountain because they're afraid of falling off the, you're like, dude, you got plenty of space. But they're terrified because they've only walked on sidewalk, you know what I mean? See a child go from that on day one to day 20 where, man, this child is running and playing and skipping and, you know what I mean? They're free. That's meaningful for me. I know you have something that no one will ever be able to take away from you. You're a little child and you've been free. Perfect. And so meaningful action is what connects us to something bigger than ourselves. Meaningful action is what enables us to live a symbolic life, to live a mystic life, right? When you're engaged in activities that in your heart you can feel the reach and the scope of those activities, this is the real experience that's behind the great mythologies. This is the real experience that's behind great, like, superheroes, right? All those great superpowers that the heroes have. That's how we feel when we are engaged in meaningful activities. The meaningful activity could just be making soup for your family. The meaningful activity could just be, you know, taking your child to their, you know, their baseball game or their dance recital. The meaningful activity could be just, you know, caring for animals in the shelter, whatever it is. There's something that you do that activates your spirit, though, because you can see and feel how what you're doing is contributing to something bigger than yourself. It gives you a superpower. It allows you to fly. It allows you to see through walls. It allows you to overcome all kinds of adversity. It's a superpower because it transcends all the limitations of your, you know, temporal reality, right? So meaningful action is synonymous with symbolic connection or symbolic connectivity, okay? Meaningful action is essential because we as people are hardwired for symbolism and mysticism. We're hardwired for divine realization, right? It's part of who we are, which again is something that we see through our dreams. When we dream, we get access to something. We encounter and experience something supernatural. No one has to tell you to be supernatural in your dreams. You just do it. It's natural. You're a supernatural being, but your supernatural being is so simple. It's like you see something in the room that nobody else sees. You smell something no one else smells. You hear something that no one else hears. It doesn't have to be that you can jump from, you know, from one building to another. Like that's the exaggerated form of it to dramatize it. But you know within yourself that if we're all sitting here and all of a sudden you see an entity come up and just sit next to you, you're having a supernatural experience. It doesn't have to move anything. It don't have to touch you. Nothing has to happen. You just have to see something walk in and you know that no one else sees it. You're going to be shook that, like, wow, I'm part of something totally extra. Right? Because we know we have this capacity. We are hardwired for supernatural experiences. So as you are able to engage in all kinds of meaningful activity, it creates a connection to something much bigger. It's almost like, again, going back to childhood, maybe you remember when you were a child and you would play. And when you would play, your imagination was just unfettered. Maybe you have children, you watch them play. You can see how they can go into an imaginary world and they can stay there for 3-4 hours, right? Just everything in the whole house is in a whole nother world. The ground is lava, of course. I don't know how everybody learned that game, but the ground is lava and the couches are mountains. And, you know, like the imagination is that's a natural part of being a human being. We have a very profound imagination. Meaningful activity taps into your imagination. because you get to envision all the different ways that making soup for your family is contributing to something so much greater, right? Washing clothes for your family is connecting you to something so much greater. Helping people cross the road or painting, whatever it is that you do, meaningful activity is meaningful for you because it activates something within your spirit. Okay. And it may just be, that's your thing. Okay. Crucial. This is super important. Now, some of the ways in which in the School of Orisha Studies, or more importantly, in the Orisha Lifestyle Academy, one of the key ways that I teach these kinds of meaningful activities is, of course, the insistence upon claiming your natural gifts and talents. That's ground zero. That's the battleground for your freedom. Claiming your natural gifts and talents. That's the battleground. That's where we're there. And I keep coming back to it because, again, meaningful activity. Listen to what I'm about to say. And this is the truth. In my mind, when I'm talking to you about claiming your natural gifts and talents, I got on my helmet. I got on my armor. I got my shield. I've got my sword. And I'm going out there and I'm facing the demons of white supremacism. I'm facing all of the colonial ideas that have conditioned you to think that you're something different than what you are. Because I've studied psychology, I've studied human development, I've studied the learning process. I know how they conditioned you. I know what they did from the seats all facing this way. You notice that? So when we did our workshop, first thing I do, put these seats in a circle. Everybody who was there will tell you. Then when they do all the other workshops, they did the workshops, rows, row, row, and everybody faces forward, which means you're looking at the back of somebody's head. I don't need to look at the back. You don't need to look at the back of somebody's head. You need to look at her face. You need to see her mouth move when she talks, even though she's not the instructor, even though he's not the instructor. Right? So I'm there and I'm fighting, putting all kinds of mechanisms in place, visually, physically, verbally, to combat all these subtle programming. They program us so profoundly from the beginning of our lives. And one of the first things that they take away from you is the recognition of your natural gifts and talents. And they make you feel like your natural gifts and talents are what make you weird. And they do make you weird. They do. But you should be, we need you to be weird. You chose to be weird. I didn't choose your weird. You chose it. So when they say you're weird, then yeah, that's right. I'm weird because I chose something that nobody else chose. Now, why did I choose it? I chose it so that I could do A, B, C, and D. One of the first things they do is they make you feel bad because your natural gifts and talents will get you in trouble. Your natural gifts and talents probably get you in trouble. They probably have gotten you in trouble since you were little. Because you see things differently. And it's just difficult to articulate what you see because you're 12, you're 13, you're 17, you're 20. It takes a long time to develop the vocabulary and the confidence and the clarity to be able to share your vision with people. But by that time, they beat it out of you and make you just conform. So one of the ways that I teach this meaningful activity is by constantly returning to the importance of your natural gifts and talents. You need those natural gifts and talents. That's your salvation. That's your key to freedom. Okay. Another way that we teach this is by constantly asking you to explore the experience from the inside out. Constantly encourage you to find ways to tap into it. So if you look at, I think the majority of people here are in the School of Orisha Studies, so this will be a meaningful example. For everyone else, I'll just explain it. We have an Odu study guide, which needs to be worked on today. And in the Odu study guide, you know, we look at the sacred text But we look at the sacred text on six different levels. Level one is just recognition. What happened? What was the sequence of events? Who was involved? This is just the facts, right? You need that. That represents the quality of your data. You need quality data. You need to know what happened. You need to know who the protagonists were. You need to know, you know, what the context of the story was. Next, we started looking at it from the perspective of, hey, what is the shape? If you were to render this story visually, what would it look like? Show me in pictures or in some kind of a 2D format how you see this spatially, right? What stood out for you and how was it laid out? What was above what? What was next to the other? What was interacting with what? What colors do you see? All this is tapping into your active imagination. We look at the way the story unfolded, the themes of the story, what happened first, what happened second, what happened third, what happened fourth, and what does this story mean? See, all these different levels of these different angles of looking at the story are intended to tap you into what's happening for you internally. How does this message unfold for you from the inside out? Right? Because as you get deeper and deeper into it, the message and the wisdom is going to apply to your natural gifts and talents. It's going to apply to your personal mission. It's going to allow you to understand how this Ifa is guiding you toward meaningful action. The things that stand out for you, the things that really were, you know, curious for you or meaningful for you are the things that are going to activate your imagination. They're going to tell you, this is what you need to be doing. This is how you need to orientate yourself. This is how you need to act right now. So we're encouraging meaningful action even through the sacred text. Okay. And then, of course, when you go through all of the books, even Orikia Won Orisha, this is just straight ahead. Half of the book is just straight ahead text. This chant, this song, that song. But the first half of the book is all about showing you where you fit into the worship cycle. Why do you need to be worshiping with these songs? What's happening when you get involved with these kinds of activities? This book it's very simple. It's very straightforward, but I just use it as an example for you to understand that everything that I'm doing is from the inside out approach. I want you to see yourself and understand yourself relative to all of these different incantations, recitations, and songs. All right? It's very important. You are at the center of your universe, and you've got to stay at the center of your universe. Now, what happens if you refuse to really tap into your, you know, your meaningful action? What happens if you refuse to accept and embrace your natural gifts and talents? What happens if you refuse to really tap into and discover and accept what motivates you, what inspires you? Then you end up in isolation. You end up with that bent dorsal fin. You might end up, and you think about it, hey, you know, a killer whale, a whale in captivity, maybe he eats on more regular intervals, and maybe his cage is cleaner, right? But his quality of life is far worse than a wild orca, right? And so this is what happens to us. We might have, you know, and this is the American dilemma. Our electricity works, our water runs, the roads are relatively good. We have all kinds of, niceties. It's a good life. Materially, it's a good life. But what do you compromise to have that good life? What are you really paying? You're paying with your spirit. You're compromising your spirit in order to have these creature comforts. And so once you recognize that's what's happening, then you put on your helmet and you get your shield and you put on your armor and you get your sword and you fight for yourself. You go into the front line of your own experience and you refuse to allow them to program you to conform. And you find ways to use what you have to engage in more and more and more meaningful activities. Okay. Now, part of the difficulty in taking on these meaningful activities is this is the entrepreneur's dilemma, right? Going to work means I get a steady paycheck. Every 2 weeks, every month, it's the same amount of money. If I venture out on my own, I might not get paid at all. It's a hit or miss. It's like maybe, maybe not. So there's a lot of risk involved in engaging in meaningful activities, right? Because you're going free range, you're going off the grid, you're coloring, you're getting, you're just outside the box, in unstructured territory, right? And so being a leader is very much like being an entrepreneur in that if you're everything. If the computer breaks, you're the repairman. If the mail doesn't come, then you got to go to the post office. If the internet fails, then you're the tech person and you got to figure that out. If you're anything that happens related to your business, it's your responsibility. And that's a life of leadership. But again, it's something that I guess if we compare it to places like outside of America, that's why I love to travel. You go to Africa, you go to Latin America, you go to the Caribbean. You see that people are more, they rely upon one another more than they rely upon, let's say, the system, because they know that there's no roadside assistance. Your car breaks down in Nigeria, bro. There ain't no roadside assistance. There ain't no Caltrans coming over there to tow your car. So people will pull over because they know that you can't get off the road. You need to build your house. You're not going to get these, development groups and, oh, me, I'm going to build a house over there. I'm going to call my brother and my uncle and my cousin. And then we're all going to go out there every week and we're going to build my house, us. And so people have a different sense of how we work together to make things happen. And so all of those things, however, what they do is they reinforce the idea that we have the capacity to do what needs to be done, even in an unstructured environment. We can make things happen. We can build and take care of ourselves and one another on our own terms. It doesn't have to all be scripted by someone else. And so meaningful action in that regard is always tied to, again, other people. It's not a solo endeavor. You're not the lone ranger. When you really get deep into meaningful action and you really get clear about what motivates you and what drives you, you're going to find that relationships are much more significant than you might have imagined otherwise. You must have relationships, must be involved in relationships. You know, and those relationships must be functional. Functional in the sense that the right hand washes the left, right? I'm doing something for you and you're doing something for me. And we just need to make agreements about how we're doing that. And as long as we're in agreement that this is what I'm going to do for you and this is what you're going to do for me, then we can continue to build and we can continue to renegotiate and we can continue to create more and more opportunities for us to be engaged in meaningful activities together. Okay. So that is the cure for alienation. It's the cure for isolation. I will venture to say it is the cure for depression. Because it creates meaning in our lives. Right? It creates meaning in our lives. So let me pause there. There's something that I did want to share. This is a little bit dense, but you might enjoy it though. And I actually recently took a course on it. This is called Ego and Archetype by Edward Edinger. Ego and Archetype by Edward Edinger. And on chapter 4, he talks about meaning, the search for meaning. So this guy is a Jungian psychologist. He's a practicing Jungian psychologist. It's not like somebody just, you know, writes papers or whatever. But he talks about the search for meaning in chapter 4. And there were a couple of parts in here that, I want to read this little portion. And then I'm going to pause and open up for questions. On page 117, he talks about meaning, and he talks about the relationship between meaning and symbols. And he says, to the extent that one is unaware of the symbolic dimension of existence, one experiences the vicissitudes of life as symptoms. To the extent that one is unaware of the symbolic dimension of existence, one experiences the vicissitudes of life as symptoms. Symptoms are disturbing states of mind which we are unable to control and which are essentially meaningless. That is, they contain no value or significance. Symptoms, in fact, are degraded symbols, degraded by the reductive fallacy of the ego. Symptoms are intolerable precisely because they are meaningless. Almost any difficulty can be borne if we can discern its meaning. It is meaninglessness which is the greatest threat to humanity. It is meaninglessness that is the greatest threat to humanity. And I think one of the key lines there is that, you know, we can endure any kind of hardship as long as it has meaning. So I you think about, you know, our ancestors, right? Who came with the knowledge? Think of our ancestors who left the continent with knowledge of self. They knew their ancestry. They knew the relationship of their craft. You know, I'm a blacksmith because my grandfather was a blacksmith, and we're all Ogun worshipers. They knew this. This is not like no one had to tell them. This is their natural state of being. And then you come to a place where someone forces you to do what you know how to do and work and toil. Like an animal in the field. Stripping you of all your human rights, denying you any kind of human dignity. And you've got to do this year after year after year after year after year after year after year. And you got to have children. And watch your children live through this. Bright children. You got a bright child with a creative mind and a bold spirit. And you got to watch your child, you know, be pummeled and punished and reduced to being like a mule. And you have to endure this year after year after year after year, decade after decade. How do you do that and not go insane? You got to create meaning. You have to create meaning. You have to understand that what I'm doing today, maybe, you know, I'll only be able to make it incrementally better for me and incrementally better for my child, but my great, great, great grandchild will have a new opportunity because of what I'm doing today. So this little task that I'm going to do right now, as demeaning as it may be for me today, as demeaning as it may be for my child today, I know that at some point, my lineage is going to be redeemed. We're going to be vindicated and we're going to be free. This little thing right now, this is one little contribution to the liberation of my lineage. And here we are today, living proof. Here we are. The sacrifice that they made paved the way for us to be where we are right now. So what we do today will equally have benefits to ourselves today, to our children, our friends, whoever we serve. Likewise, future generations will benefit from our contribution. If we are willing to commit to these kinds of meaningful activities, who knows what kinds of results we can create in the years and generations to come. So I'm going to pause there because we're just at an hour. And so we got about half an hour, and I want to entertain any questions that you might have. I see one hand up already. So let's start there, and then we'll go forward. So if you have any question or any concern, any further clarification, now's the time to raise your hand and we'll go into it. All right. It is, I know it's Shanice, right? But it says Sunny. Is it Shanice? Yes. All right. Good afternoon.
Hey, Baba. How are you?
It's getting better. How are you?
I'm good. First of all, grace and thankfulness, Iba Ogun, for making sure that y'all got back safely. Very happy. Again, you must hear me talking to myself about you while I'm driving, while I'm doing things. Because, well, first of all, just for the group, for everyone, I apologize for not having the notes from the prior lesson up yet. Everything will be up on Friday. This lesson, the last lesson, and the question and answering session for each of the lessons will all be up by Friday. Awesome. And I'll make sure that I have a scheduled time to make everything available, because Baba, I know that you use those notes and everyone else, and I want to make sure everybody's prepared before they come into the leadership meeting and able to do their journal. So I want to do my part and make sure I'm doing it authentically and well. Okay.
Thank you. That is greatly, greatly appreciated.
Absolutely. My responsibility, I picked it up. I took it on. So I want to make sure I stay true to that, because it's for everybody, right? So one of the things that I have understood was that I've always had kind of an aversion to leadership. I didn't want to be a leader. I didn't want to hear that I'm a leader, because I was raised in a management household. My mom is a person manager. Okay. And as a person manager, that causes people who have leadership qualities to kind of not be able to be as creative or as focused or driven on their leadership and what they're trying to, like, the goal, because they're being managed from someone else's goals. Right. So that's always kind of been an aversion to me until today. I was like, yo, you know, there's a significant difference. But one thing that I appreciate about you is that I know the quality of a leader you are, that you are an excellent follower, because you can't be a gracious leader without being able to have been led. And that is one of those lessons that I am really embarking on, so that I can be the leader that I am supposed to be able to stand in the front that I'm supposed to and take the responsibilities. And that means being a good follower. So I'm grateful to have a leader that I'm able to follow and see those intrinsic values, because that's meaningful to me. A lot of times anybody can be a leader. Anybody can take courses to become a leader, learn how to be charismatic, learn how to talk to people, whoop-de-woo, and have ulterior motives. Mm-hmm. And it's a difference, and you can tell the difference. Mm-hmm. But because they don't know how to follow someone who is trying to be a leader under their tutelage, right? They don't know how to step back and be like, yeah, you know what? Go ahead, because I know you can do it. Mm-hmm. They still have to do everything. You know, they still have to be like, well, you know, I taught you this. So, and, you know, micromanaging, mm-hmm. Recognizing, like, I've just been watching you, and I've been watching you for a very long time, mm-hmm. longer than you know, I have been watching you. And it's obvious the difference between leadership models. So one of the things that I noticed is that when you don't have a goal, when you don't have a central purpose, everything else falls out to the wayside. As artists, you kind of like dive into different things because you're just trying to find a medium, mm-hmm. right? You don't have a goal. So anytime you're pivoting, where are you pivoting to? You know, what is this pivot for? What is the meaning of this pivot? And I think a lot about leadership is knowing that this is the goal. This is the purpose. Bringing about good condition is the goal, is the purpose. That is the value that when you come in here, you know that this is the focus point. If that's not your focus, that's cool, but this ain't for you because this is where we are. If you can't identify why it's integral for us to have this, if you can't identify the issues, if you can't identify the need for good leadership and to be a good leader in this, then this may not be that ministry for you.
Right.
That's not to say that there isn't one for you or there isn't a place for you, but you have to reconcile that this right here, that is the central purpose. Everything that our leadership does here is for bringing about the good condition for a Yoruban-centered diaspora in life.
Right.
Diaspora. I'm a better writer than I am speaker sometimes. But,
yeah.
But seeing that and valuing that in you, it makes me want to be a better person or step into my place. I'm like, yo, I can't fall back on my responsibilities. I have to make sure that I'm hitting my targets because they're meaningful to me, because this goal, this vision is meaningful to me. So my positions have to be played, and it's not that they can't be played correctly. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can make mistakes. Obatala made mistakes. Oshun has made mistakes. Every Orisha has made a mistake. That is part of their human experience, but it's not to linger in it and not grow from it. Like, you still have to get back where you're supposed to be. Obatala made acts, you know, he found out that palm wine was not his thing. Right. And he made his taboo. Like, okay, you know what? No more palm wine, because I need to be here to be able to perform in the capacity in which I am expected to be able to perform in. And those are all kind of key observances that I see and recognize as far as myself in trying to step into place. So thank you. I'm not going to take up any more time. I'm at work and I was like, I'm not taking a call until I say what I need to say.
I said, thank you for saying so. On all accounts, you know, you covered a lot of crucial points there, including one of my favorites, which is the fallibility of the Orisha. You know, we really underemphasize that. We love the Orisha because of their greatness, but it is precisely their greatness that created their biggest problems. That's what I mean. Like, your natural gifts and talents probably have caused you some problems. You probably got into major trouble for what you do naturally, just because you didn't really, you know what I mean? It takes time to figure it out. Obatala made his mistakes. Ogun made his mistakes. Shango made his mistakes. Oshu made every Orisha makes their mistakes. And in reality, more than half of the time, it is that mistake that actually, their ownership of the mistake, not the mistake. Their ownership of the mistake is what elevates them to deified status. So like you mentioned, Obatala now is the caretaker for everybody who has some kind of a deficiency or some kind of a deformity as a result of his drunkenness. You know, those are his special people. They work in his temple. They are, and they have a special function. He takes ownership. He's their caretaker, right? So thank you very much for all those things. There's a lot more I would like to say, but for the sake of time, we're going to keep it moving. And thank you so much for your contribution. Okay, we have Brother Jegbe. Good afternoon. What's on your mind? Oh, wait, what did I do? I think I have this.
I identify with a lot of what you said, especially that state of meaninglessness. And I think whether or not you're in the golden handcuffs, no matter what side of the divide you are, you struggle with meaningless, right? If the society is unmoored, right? If you're a entrepreneur or, you know, somebody who's interested in service in a world that is morally bankrupt or off balance, you know, it's the same thing as being, you know, in a stable position in the society, but looking to be in service. There's a, you know, an equal but opposite sort of meaninglessness to it. And so I was, you know, doing a lot of self-investigation. This is definitely one that I'm going to have to play back. What I kind of wanted to ask you or maybe bring to your attention, have you ever heard of, so Viter is currently popular. He has a piece of technology he calls the story circle. And it's Campbellian. The way that he writes is based on Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, you know, and he's plotted out these 8 different points. I'll send you a copy of it, you know, like a breakdown of it, Dan Harmon's story circle. It kind of came to mind as I'm thinking about this this point of meaninglessness and the journey to embrace your natural gifts and talents from that state into a place where you're integrated, you know, symbolically, morally, as job function, as a hero's journey, you know, that we need to, you know, as a writer, you know, at least a potential one, you know, to some degree, I think people need stories that allow them to see themselves symbolically linked to the hero's journey. You know, it's what enables us to, I mean, it's why the time work the way they do to some degree, right? We put ourselves in that story. We see ourselves arriving at the departure point of this particular story better. And then we put ourselves in symbolic resonance with that. I wanted to, because that's a specific area of nerddom that I'm into, you know, is the Campbellian story circle stuff. I'm going to share that with you. And maybe it'll be some useful use to the group. But yeah, that's my little insight.
Nice. Thank you, sir. I look forward to seeing it. The hero's journey is a great tool for kind of mapping this experience of self-discovery and self-expression. So I love it for that. Okay, we have Ms. Cabrera, Gloria. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Aboru, Oboye, Obo Cheshi, and Alafia, everyone.
Right, Alafia, Neo.
I wanted to say 2 things. First, I wanted to kind of go back. I had shared last week about my experiences in some spiritual houses.
Yeah.
But I want to say that when I first entered this religion, it was through Baba Jose Ibaye Baye. He was an Oriate from the Cuban, old school Cuban tradition. Yeah. And I sat with him. And I would visit him regularly and I would sit with him. And it was funny because I never had the father. So I would go there and just sit at his table quiet and just be with him and get to know him. And I did that for like 10 years. Of course, we had a better relationship, but I was very blessed that he shared his love with the Orishas with me. He was a simple man, a very widely respected Oriate, but he shared his love with me, and he did not teach me things because I was not initiated back then, so but that's okay. But and so in he groomed that in me, and I'm very appreciative to that very day. He's on my boda. And he also said you could ask Orishas to help you, but you have to do your part.
Shame.
You have to work, you have to do your part. So when you say that, it really resonated with me. And I just also want to say that I feel as though I was spiritually guided to this workshop with you, because I had been praying for guidance and to grow, because I do find that, you know, in my work, Gloria Licious, it is a combination of craft in religion, my religious, my spirituality, and there's no way they go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. So I find myself attracting people who need help and who I want to help. So that, and so I do crafts, but then also I was always told that your words are your mm-hmm. ache. And I didn't really, I thought that meant just talking, mm-hmm. but I'm also a writer and a poet.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm writing now and I'm growing and I'm looking, you know, I'm looking for people to help me tell my story about what it means to have grown spiritually, what it means to decolonize, what it means to have overcome injuries through with the religion, with my spirituality helping me along the way.
Yes.
So I guess I'm very blessed to be here and grateful.
I say, and we're thankful that you're here with us as well. You remind me of again on the eighth week, you know, where the feature is. So I hope we can be kind of leaning toward that. I want us to showcase what we're doing, because I am certain that the other people, or there are several other people here who are in this class who are like you, and have something, either an emerging talent or a talent that's already reached a certain level of refinement, and it's ready to be, you know, packaged up, or it's already packaged up and shared. And so by the eighth week, what we do is we focus on leadership in crisis. I call it leadership in crisis, which is basically just, you know, when you encounter a new crossroads, that's a crisis. Am I going to go right? Am I going to go left? Do I go forward? Do I, you know what I mean? Like, this is a little bit of a dilemma. And one of the keys to really being successful of leading in a crisis is sharing the burden. So, you know, you bear the burden of your natural gifts and talents over your life. And then how do you create opportunities to share it with other people? Who needs to know about your poetry? Who needs to know about your craft? Who needs to know about what you bring, and who needs to be healed, helped, inspired, guided by your story? And that's kind of the idea that I want to bring to life starting in that eighth week. Let's share with one another what we're doing, what we bring to the table, and what we've been holding on to. And Shanice was saying the same thing. You know, it's like a little different, where it's like, oh, I'm a little reluctant to take that thing and, you know, say I'm the leader, and but I know I got it, I could, but okay, this is the chance. Let's share. How do you want to lead? How do you want to share? How do you want people to recognize what you do? And then let all of us share it across all of our networks and see what happens. Because I know that it's very gratifying when you recognize that this thing that really does soothe your own spirit has a similar and sometimes even greater effect on other people's spirit. That's what I was, you know, talking about with, like, this is your, you realize, oh my goodness, I have a superpower. You know, I have a superpower. I can't stop a moving train or something like that, but I can say things that have a really profound impact on people. I can show up and do the thing that I always would do, and it really opens people's minds, opens people's hearts. That is empowering, very, very empowering. So let's see here. Thank you very much, Gloria. And we're gonna go to, we have our sister Ivy. This probably will be our, when we wrap it up. Ivy, oops, my goodness, sorry, Ivy. Don't like that.
Can you hear me, Baba?
Yeah, I can hear you. How you doing?
I'm okay. I'm bored of boy yet, boy shishé.
Boy, so.
So I wanted to share, because the last thing that you said really resonated with me about how you realize that you have a superpower, when many times you may have gone through life just thinking, oh, this is just what I do, right? So like, if Superman didn't have a father to tell him, hey, everybody can't just pick up a truck and toss it, right? He'd think it was normal, right? If he was back on Krypton with everybody else. So for me, the current job that I'm doing has been that vehicle. So I'm doing intake coordination for an employee assistance program, and it doesn't pay a lot, but there's been a lot of value and richness in the experience in my being able to see in real time my skills. So if I'm working with someone as a client and I'm working with them over months, right? It takes over months to see the impact, right? And maybe they might stop or maybe some other thing might happen. But in a very discrete time period, in a call where someone is having a panic attack, where they're dealing with suicidal ideation, I'm able to very, in a very short time period, see and experience the change in that person. So let's say, for example, if they're having a panic attack and they're talking really fast and they're crying and what have you, at the start of the conversation, but by the end of the conversation, their breathing is calmer. They start yawning because they're ready to go to bed, right? And so it shows that they've calmed down, and that's a direct impact from the conversation. And one of the greatest experiences I had was there was a woman who called, and her adult child had passed away suddenly. And she was literally scream crying on the phone. And she's like, I'm going to go. And I'm like, no, don't do that. Stay on the phone with me. It's fine. Like, this is what I'm here for. And I can't even remember what I said, but I said something that got her to laugh. And she was like, you know what? I didn't even think I would be able to laugh, you know? And she was so grateful. And for me, then it clicked. I'm like, no, I really do have a gift, because I don't even remember what I said.
Right.
So for her to go from scream crying to laughing to being ready to go to bed.
Right.
Right. That all happened in that discrete period of time of talking to me.
Wow. Wow. Talk about talking somebody down from the ledge.
Yeah, literally. And every day.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that's You get real tangible evidence of what you're doing in that kind of work, because that is the front line. That is the front line. And I suppose that once you know that that's where you're, you know, that is where you can show up and be effective, then it becomes a question of, Okay, accepting it, honing it, kind of getting more skilled at it, and figuring out who you get the most from when you do that work.
So that's a really great point, because early on, I had a friend who helped me to set an intention, because in the beginning, the calls that I were getting were really stressful. And then he helped me to set an intention that the people who would reach me, who would talk to me, that they would pour into me the same way that I would pour into them.
Right.
And ever since then, my call volume has been different. The types of calls that I get are different. And they all have something to teach me. So, you know, for example, I had a homicidal ideation this week where somebody was thinking about killing someone. And that taught me a lot, because he didn't call in for that. He called in for another service. Oh. But because I asked the questions that I asked,
wow.
Then I asked the question and he answered it honestly.
Wow.
And that blew me away, because it's like, no, I really did make a difference, because based on what he shared, there was no reason for me to explore that. It's just a question I always ask.
Right.
And because I always ask it, he answered it honestly. And it's like, oh yeah, let's get you some help.
Yeah, you don't have to do that. You don't have to do that. There are other options for you. Wow. Yes. Yeah. And that is like, when we think about what feeds us as service providers, it's important that we take, you know, we take that into account and set those kinds of intentions. It says, yes, I do. I recognize that everybody needs help and everybody deserves help, right? That is absolutely the case. And I myself am not going to deny anybody service. You come to me and I got what you need. I'm going to help you. Mm-hmm. But I am a person and I need my battery charged.
Yeah.
So I need to find out where is it that kind of, some kind of a, somehow by doing this work, no matter how difficult it is, excuse me, no matter how difficult it is. And when I do this work with this group of people, it's everything for me. It gives me life after life after life. I'm so charged up.
Yeah.
In this work. And sometimes we need results. We need people who are going to be, perhaps we need people who are going to be honest. What I need my people, if I ask you this question, mm-hmm. I need you to be honest with me.
Yeah.
If you're honest with me, then that's like, boom, I can go all the way. Other people, I need feedback. You know, some other person may, you know, you're a service provider, you need your clientele and people you serve to give you feedback or whatever the case may be, you know, in different segments of the society is totally different. You know, like being a human services professional is one thing, but there's other kinds of work that are totally different. Artists and bankers and et cetera. It's the same thing. We need to be really aware of, once we know that this is how we're going to show up and this is what we're going to do for the people that we're serving, then we also need to acknowledge within ourselves, this is what we need.
Yeah.
In order to do that work to the highest level.
Yeah.
As Gloria said before, you know, I can ask Orisha for this, but I got to do my part. And part of the people that I was like, my people, they got to be willing to do the work. I'll tell you and give you and blah, 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 blah. But I got to see that you're willing to get your hands dirty. You're willing to let your hair get messed up. You know what I'm saying? Like, you look crazy right now, but that's mm-hmm. because you're doing the work.
Yeah.
Keep doing the work and I will too. So for each of us, it's essential that we do that. We start taking inventory of what kinds of reciprocity we also need from the people that we serve in order for it to be worth your effort, worth your time, worth your energy, your whatever it is that you're putting into that relationship. Because it's a relationship. You know, so we're at 2 hours and 29 minutes exactly. I want to really, really, really thank you all for participating in our conversation. Next week, we're going to talk about the importance of, I guess we could call it honest assessment, whereby you see people for how they really are. Right? And this is something that's particularly the case for people who are service providers. There's something that goes into being a service provider. You have to, maybe you don't have to, but at least the way I was trained, is that you elevate your client. You see the divinity in your client. You see the nobility in your client. They come in and they're all disheveled and talking madness, but somehow you look and you say, but I see a great woman there. I see a great man. I see someone with so much dignity there, and that's who I'm going to talk to. I know where you are right now, but I'm talking to you at this state, this other level that I see that really is you. Now that works, but at the same time, I got to see you where you are though. But right now, you're rabid and insane, and you're liable to do any old thing. So I got to accept that that's where you are right now, even though you got the potential to do something else. Right now, I can't leave my wallet in the room with you. See how they really are, and accept them how they really are, and be willing to embrace or let go accordingly. Right? Very important. We got that. That's kind of what we're going to go into. Sometimes we get so invested one way or the other, either in the other person, or we get so invested in the cause, or we get so invested in the group, or we get so invested in our idea of those things that we end up, you know, stagnating. Because for whatever reason, they're not evolving right now, or they're not evolving at the rate that you think they are, you know what I mean? And so you're going at 80 miles per hour, but they're only going 40, and it, you know what I mean? It creates another dynamic. So we're going to talk about that. Seeing people how they really and truly are, and so that it doesn't drain you, so that something that you really want to do and something you really love doesn't end up becoming something else. Being able to position yourself and put yourself in places where you are being fed, you are being inspired, you know, where maybe you're comfortable in an environment, but it's a small pond and you're a bigger fish, and that's why you like it there. Sometimes you know what, like they say, if you're the smartest person in the room, if you're always the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. And so, you know, accepting that kind of, you know, evaluating the situation and the circumstances for that, and accepting that, hey, you know what, I got to get into a bigger pond. I got to go where the blades are sharper, etc. And that's what we're going to go into next week. So until then, what I'd like you to do is to give more thought to, you know, creating meaningful action for yourself, positioning yourself so that you can not only engage in meaningful activity, but you can be, you know, you can be fed from it. And so how do you choose meaningful activities that also inspire you, feed you, really give you that kind of replenishment that you need to go further and go higher? So until then, many blessings to you all, and I'll talk to you in 7 days. Okay, until then, odabo.